This interview is being conducted with First Lieutenant Glenn E. Wynn by Gunnery Sergeant Floyd N. Jordan at Marine Corps Schools, Quantico, Virginia, on 11 January 1966. The subject of this interview is the initial landing of 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, and problems of occupying general areas, and it is unclassified. Would you state your name, grade, and service number, please?
My name is Lieutenant, First Lieutenant Glenn E. Wynn. Service number is 085544.
Lieutenant Wynn, what were your duty assignments while you were in Vietnam?
While I was in Vietnam, my duty assignments consisted of XO of a 105 direct support artillery battery, Bravo battery 112, and then I took over headquarters battery 112, and for the last week that I was in Vietnam, I was the CO of Foxtrot battery 212, and then subsequently brought it out of Vietnam and brought the battery with 3rd Battalion 9th Marines back to Okinawa for its normal rotation.
What period did you actually serve in these billets, and where were you physically located within Vietnam during the period discussed?
Well, with Bravo Battery 112 supporting 2nd Battalion 3rd Marines, I landed with the 2nd Battalion 3rd Marines on the 10th of April, 1965, and stayed with Bravo Battery until the end of April. And then from approximately the 1st of May until the second week of June, 1965, I was the CO of Headquarters Battery 112, and then subsequently was the CO of Foxtrot Battery 212 and brought it out of Vietnam. The exact location of Bravo Battery, we remained on the airfield at Da Nang for about 4 hours, from about 2 o'clock in the morning, 0200 on the 11th of April, until about 0600 on the 11th of April, and then moved off the airfield to the Da San Khan San area, north of the main airfield complex, about 3.5 to 4 miles. And the billet that I held as CO of Headquarters Battery 112, I was located in the same area right next to the village of Khan San, and the same with Foxtrot Battery. This was our main battery positions, and from these positions we moved out on our battery recons and for our support missions of the infantry units that we supported.
During our preliminary interview, you spoke of some problems in the initial landing with the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. Would you elaborate on these, please?
Our biggest problem was coordination. We had received an order while we were afloat about or approximately the 8th of April of 1965, which directed us to, first of all, the entire BLT had been on an operation in Thailand during the month of March and the first part of April. We were proceeding from Thailand back to Subic Bay in the Philippines and had received our orders to proceed and take station in the general area between Da Nang and the city of Hue off the coast of Vietnam. And then we stood in this position for about 3 days. And as I said, we found out that we were actually landing in Vietnam on the 10th of April when we actually pulled into the harbor at Da Nang. And I was the XO of troops on the USS Gunston Hall, and the CO of troops and I were both awakened at about 3 o'clock in the morning by the skipper of the ship, and nobody at that time had received definite orders to go ashore or make preparations for the landing. It was strictly on our own and from what messages we could send from ship to ship that we began preparing our people, breaking out the ammunition, getting the ammunition stored aboard the vehicles, the tankers, Antos and LVT personnel located on the same ship with us had to go through the same thing, but we had to give them the word, and it was strictly on our own. The final landing order was given to us at 0700 on the 10th of April, and the first wave hit the beach at 0800 on the 10th of April. This was a time lag of 1 hour, and which the people had to come over with the command group from the APA that was in our convoy, get aboard our ship into the LVTs, form up the first wave and go in, and they actually hit the beach at 0800. And then once they were ashore, two companies were heli-lifted immediately from the beach area to Wei Fubai, which is 45 miles to the north. And at this time, we immediately lost contact with two of our FOs and half of our liaison team, which were flown up to the Wei Fubai area to establish liaison with the two companies that were sent there. So when we actually brought our battery ashore, which started at about 1600 in the afternoon of the 10th, we had been waiting to go ashore from about 6 o'clock in the morning, as I said, 0600 of the 10th, until 1600 that afternoon. We finally got the order to bring the artillery battery ashore. And this biggest problem in this case was the boats available. There weren't enough LCUs. There was one LCU in our LSD, and there was one other stationed at Da Nang at this particular time. And with an entire BLT hitting the beach, plus all of the support elements, it was almost an impossibility to get all the personnel and equipment ashore as they were needed. And the artillery battery, finally, I came in with the rear element, being the XO of the battery, and I met my battery commander, who had gone in with the first wave of LVTs at 0800 of the 10th. I met him at 0100 on the morning of the 11th. So this was a time lag of about 20 hours. I hadn't seen the CO of the battery or the first elements of the battery. I met him on the airfield and then was briefed at 0100 in the morning that we were leaving at 0600 to pull into initial position north of the airfield. So actual time spent on the airfield and getting oriented to the immediate area, briefings and so on, were so minute that made no difference. We were strictly going and dead reckoning most of the way until we get into our first position.
Do you feel that this time lag in getting the battalion ashore was detrimental to the actual mission of your battery?
I could answer that in two ways. I could say yes, it was detrimental because actually orienting the personnel in our battery, being their first touch with any type of combat. If I remember correctly, we had four people in the entire battery who had any previous combat experience at all. Getting them oriented to the area that we were in, the environment we were in, plus trying to orient ourselves so that we wouldn't be walking into any ambushes or anything of this nature as soon as we left the airfield. And then on the other hand, I can say no, because once we put our battery ashore, the six howitzers were set up in immediate positions on the airfield in spite of the lack of the after half of the battery, which contained your FDC vehicles, most of your comm vehicles, and so on. We could have fired if it had been necessary.
Did your unit operate in a TAOR while you were ashore?
Yes, we operated within the TAOR in our primary battery positions and then in support of the battalion recon from the 3rd Marine Division, in support of various companies which went outside of the TAOR on patrolling missions. I think it would be good to bring up this time that every one of the companies that did leave the TAOR was supported by a 105 howitzer battery following them as they went on patrol, not from the primary position, but moving up, staying always about 3,000 meters, between 2,500 and 3,000 meters behind the company on the move. Or the infantry were supported by one of the 8-inch howitzers, or they were supported by a platoon of 155 howitzers. So they always had enough fire that they could call in case of any difficulties.
From your point of view, the influence of Vietnam weather and terrain on personnel, to include physical conditioning, morale, and similar instances, what is your opinion, sir?
Well, the greatest problem that we ran into was getting the people acclimated. We thought that after being in the Orient, and most of the people in our battery had been committed on BLTs from their time of their arrival in the Okinawa area and the Philippines, etc. And as I had stated earlier, we had just come from a jungle operation in Thailand, which took up most of the month of March of 1965. We thought that we were pretty well acclimated until we actually get into the Vietnam atmosphere, and it was an atmosphere that I had never experienced before. I thought it was hotter there than any place I'd been in the Far East. And actual temperature-wise, I think we proved that just by taking thermometer readings. It ranged in our battery positions without a wind at noon, and most days it was 110 to 120 degrees. And of course, in the areas that we were located in, we had no shade, and we had several cases of heat stroke and heat exhaustion. And this again was due to the fact that we were short on personnel. So all of these things went together. Besides the amount of mosquitoes and centipedes that we had to contend with, centipedes that we hit or ran into, or they ran into us, were usually about anywhere from 6 to 8 inches long. And several people that did get bit by them, one man was paralyzed for a period of about 48 hours. The entire left side of his body was paralyzed. And two other people within our battery had the same thing happen to them, but just got violently ill, constant vomiting and so on. But this was an entirely new environment for all of us, which we had all thought that we knew pretty well what it was going to be like, but it was nothing like that when we got ashore.
Did you encounter any unusual problems in logistics or intelligence or personnel other than the initial shortage of personnel?
Well, our initial shortage of personnel, we thought it was only going to be initial, but our personnel shortages actually got to a point where we had such a lack of personnel that it became a task just to keep up our direct support of the infantry units, and this particular personnel status at its low ebb stayed that way until about the first week of June, when we finally started to receive some replacements.
A supply of artillery ammunition, or resupply of ammunition for the artillery batteries, were there any problems encountered here, sir?
Yes. Actual supply of optical gear was a great problem down there, because the FLSG unit that was established on the airfield at Da Nang, the actual support unit for repairing of all small optical equipment, was such a small detachment that they couldn't handle any major repairs. We thus had to have them put priorities through to get the parts flowing down to us from Okinawa, and this had sometimes put one and two howitzers out of action in our particular battery. Due to the pan sights, it put our aiming circles out at various times and so on.
Do you speak French, sir?
I speak a little French, and this was one of the problems that we got into in Vietnam. None of us had realized that the people in our particular area around Da Nang spoke as much French as they did. The French between three officers in our battery who had a language background, we'd put together things that we wanted to say in French, and this way we got by some of the peasant populace, the older people in the rural areas, in the little villages around where we were established, our battery position. We were able to get across them exactly what we were doing, suddenly setting up a battery position in their backyard, so to say. And it turned out that we were set up in a graveyard, which in Vietnam is a very critical thing, and you just don't start digging up with TD-18s and dropping your trails right into the actual cemetery itself. And we almost had a little problem with the village. They came out and decided to remove all of the bodies that had been buried of their ancestors in our area, and we didn't know what this the first encounter that we had with these people. We had about 25 villagers come out carrying a great big long wooden box painted in bright colors. We expected that this was a mining operation or something that they were going to pull on us. We didn't know, and it was very ceremoniously done. We didn't want to shake up the status quo we had with the people in our area, so we had to stand there very reverently while they dug up their ancestors, removed them and put them in their own boxes, and actually took them to other grave areas. And every battery that I know down there, in the Da Nang area in particular, ran into this problem. And the 8-inch platoon that was established about 500 to 600 meters behind our position ran into this problem to a point where they actually were put under attack for 5 to 6 nights in a row by a small guerrilla band of probably estimated to be 5 or 6 people. They sustained about 3 to 4 people with grenade casualties, and the same thing happened to the 155 battery. We in turn all then had to form an emergency type platoon that we could send from battery to battery, whichever one was happened to be receiving fire and so on at night or being put under attack. The infantry was ahead of us, actually was on all sides of us, and here we were behind the infantry actually sustaining these small guerrilla attacks at night, and the infantry would sit up on the hills surrounding us, 327, 278, and 268, and look down on us and watch little games being played in our positions by the guerrillas, and they were getting nothing up in their area at all.
Do you have any observations on the equipment and weapons that provided your unit?
Yes, I do. The equipment that we had was a very serious lack of new equipment. Our equipment was well maintained in our battery by the personnel we had. When we landed in Vietnam, it was in very good condition, but it was old. And this proved itself about 30 days after we landed in Vietnam. Two of our howitzers were dated back to Tinian and Saipan, 105 howitzers dating back that far. They had been maintained in their 6-month maintenance status. They'd been inspected properly before we left Okinawa on our float phase. Everything, according to our records, was proper. These howitzers were dug in a rice paddy area up around the village of Li Mai. In a rainstorm which took place that night, the rice paddy gave way and we had our entire battery sunk literally up to its axles in the paddies. We got LVTs to come over and pull us out, and the LVTs managed to break off the trails on one howitzer, and the other howitzer, in firing about 2 days later, actually fired once and the trails dropped, one trail dropped right off the howitzer. It could have been very serious because there was nothing there to actually hold the howitzer forward on its recoil and could have recoiled right back on somebody.
Do you have any recommendations to prevent this for future units, or do you have an opinion as to why this happened, sir?
The only opinion that I would have is that the Marine Corps, in their attempt of maintaining their equipment as they always have, probably one thing that was forgotten was the age in the equipment. And when we were committed, I think all of us probably lacked the foresight to see that with this constant moving as we were doing, with the type of terrain we were crossing, that this equipment would finally start to give way. Little parts would begin to break and so on, and it was due nothing more than to the age of the equipment. The only thing I can say was that we needed at that time newer equipment, and I do know that it was replaced after I left.
Communications, as you saw it within the artillery batteries, portable FM radios, did they satisfy small unit communications?
In some cases they did, and in some cases they didn't. The particular equipment that I'm referring to would be the PRC-9 radio. The PRC-9 radio was fine for about the first 2 to 3 weeks we were ashore, and after that we ran into tremendous problems with it, both in its range. We ran into problem of getting batteries supplied, and batteries just would last maybe 1 or 2 hours of operation, and then they were done.
Thank you very much, sir.